On this episode of Newt's World, like many of you, I watched President Biden's speech to Congress on Wednesday night. He addressed a House chamber of 200 invited guests. I used to be speaker there, and frankly, the chamber probably holds up to 1,600 people. I call this the empty room speech. You know, the Democrats are so busy creating this spectacle about COVID and mask wearing. All the members of the House have had vaccinations. They've all got masks. The idea that a foreign government, somebody like Putin or Xi Jinping, is watching on television an America that is now so frightened, so timid, so unwilling to take risks, that it gives a speech with, think about this, one out of every eight seats was taken. The rest were empty. And by the way, as a speechmaker, let me tell you, if you're trying to arouse a crowd and seven out of eight seats are vacant, you got a big problem. I mean, Biden on a good day is not exactly getting people jumping up and down with excitement. But you put him in a room at 9 o'clock at night with virtually nobody else in the room, and we are talking about dull, dull, dull. So maybe this was the dull, dull, dull empty room speech. What you heard Wednesday night was a proposal to spend another $3.8 trillion on a radical left-wing Democratic wish list. In Biden's first 3 months in office, he has proposed and passed the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. And now he's proposing the $2 trillion American Jobs Plan and the $1.8 trillion American Families Plan. The White House issued a statement saying, quote, "The American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan are once-in-a-generation investments in our nation's future. The American Jobs Plan will create millions of good jobs, rebuild our country's physical infrastructure and workforce, and spark innovation and manufacturing here at home. The American Families Plan is an investment in our children and our families, helping families cover the basic expenses that so many struggle with now, lowering health insurance premiums, and continuing the American Rescue Plan's historic reductions in child poverty. Together, these plans reinvest in the future of American economy and American workers and will help us outcompete China and other countries around the world." At least, that was the White House version. Except, here's the problem with what the Biden administration is saying. While they may have already spent $1.9 trillion on the American Rescue Plan, together with the Jobs and Families Plan, we're talking about another $3.8 trillion in spending, bringing the total spending in the first 100 days to a shocking $5.7 trillion. Now, you don't need to be an economist to know that the current national debt is $28 trillion, and these additional almost $6 trillion will bring the debt to $34 trillion. So while he says he's helping families who are struggling to make ends meet, you can guarantee that he's also bankrupting their children's future. In addition, he wants to raise the corporate tax and the capital gains tax and essentially take a sledgehammer to our economy by enacting tax and spend policies that we know from history simply do not work. In 1994, I was the last Speaker of the House to work with then-Democratic President Bill Clinton on four consecutive balanced budgets. Long gone are those days. This Democratic president cares nothing about a balanced budget. He wants to spend and spend and spend. And eventually, the collector will come asking for payment. It may not be you or me paying it back, but you better believe our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren may not have as good a life as we've lived because of this spending. I wanted to spend some time today with Frank Luntz, who's a longtime friend. He's a political consultant and polling expert, and someone I look to regularly to give me guidance on what the country's thinking. Way back in 1993, I first met Frank Luntz, who had done amazing work on populism in Western Canada and on Rudy Giuliani's campaign. And Frank had developed very unique insights that almost no Republican had on the opportunity to represent people who truly felt that nobody spoke for them.
He was a major factor in shaping the contract with America. And I think that the 94 campaign would have been much, much harder without him. And so we have actually been friends for a very long time. I was very fortunate to be able to be with him yesterday. We chatted some, and I was reminded of just how really smart he is about what's going on in American politics. So I'm going to put him on the spot for a few minutes. And let me start, because it is the day after the president's address to part of the Congress. What was your reaction to Biden last night and to the whole performance?
I'm glad that you emphasized the word performance, because it was barely a speech. And I'll tell you, before we get into Biden, we have to get into you, Mr. Speaker. I've worked for some incredible people. I've been very blessed to get to travel with Tony Blair and to work with Angela Merkel, to get to know Bibi Netanyahu right when he left the UN, and to know him for two decades. Vicente Fox down in Mexico. Mr. Gingrich, there is nobody like you. And I'm going to just do two stories, because if I didn't do it, I'd be angry at myself. I've had the most fascinating life, because in a brunch in 1993, I sat with you and Vin Weber, and you gave me a piece of advice that I don't know if you told other people, but in doing that, you changed my trajectory. And by the way, you and I haven't even spoken. It didn't come up yesterday, but I'd actually not seen you, Newt, since I had a stroke back last January. And so if you hear, I have trouble tripping over words a little bit and trouble occasionally enunciating. My head is still working fine, but the tongue does not always produce what the head would like it to. And the reason why I'm perseverant is the reason why I became a language guy. We sat down over brunch and you said to me that the one thing that the movement did not have was someone to teach it how to talk, someone to find the words, the phrases, and to take these ideas, of which Newt was having at about a rate, I don't want to exaggerate, let's say a rate of about one every 5 minutes. And so he drove his staff crazy. They would go through yellow legal pads in a matter of 3 or 4 days, just trying to keep up with him. But I became a linguist. I became a, what I call myself as a word guy, because of Newt Gingrich and his advice to try to figure out how to communicate these complicated concepts and these really important, essential elements for promoting freedom. And the other thing I'd want to share with you is that I had the chance to be with the speaker minutes after his debate performance in 2012, when he single-handedly took down a CNN news anchor who was trying to take him down. And from that day on, politicians knew that if they fought back, they had a chance of winning. I'm sure it was not a good moment for you emotionally, but in terms of having an impact on politics, what you did in challenging a powerful news leader in improper and immoral behavior allowed Donald Trump to do the same thing in 2016 and set the tone for politics forever, that you guys deserve respect, you deserve decency, you deserve honesty and integrity in the questions that they ask you. And so, Newt, not only have you changed my life, but you changed the life of this country. And I could not imagine America without you. And you need to know one more thing, and I apologize, but this is a personal relationship here. And I would hope that the people on this call don't just want to be informed, they want to understand the relationships that develop. I never appreciated George Washington and what he went through at Valley Forge and who he was as an individual. And I bet you don't remember this, because this was not a significant session for us, but it was for me. We sat down for an hour, maybe 3-4 years ago, when I told you I was giving up and I'd had enough. And we sat in your office and you started to tell me for 20 minutes, because you can't tell anything in less than 20 minutes. And you told me about George Washington and how courageous he was and how special he was and how, thank God, he was a leader for us. Mr. Speaker, George Washington at the Constitutional Congress, he is on the roof of my condo, because you taught me how important he was and learning about him. And I read a dozen books about him because of you. I'm here, not just in this house and not just in politics. I'm here on this earth because of you. And I hope people listen to what you say and how you say it, because my God, what you got in your head and what you have in your heart is essential. And we don't appreciate it enough. So I'll stop.
Wow, that's a pretty amazing testimonial. And our friendship, as I think people can tell, goes back a long way and is very real. Despite all that, I'm going to put you back on the spot. Yes. What did you think of Biden's performance?
The speech yesterday was so mediocre. And this man has been working and preparing for this since 1988. The fact that there were no memorable lines, there was no aspiration. He tells people to get the vaccine by saying, get the vaccine. That's literally his pitch to them. That it called on more government spending than even Barack Obama. And he made promises the governor's a centrist and to be a unifier, and he's doing exactly the opposite. I was so disappointed because yesterday he had a chance to write himself into the history books as being the guy that healed the nation and put us back on our feet. And instead, he will be written in the history books as the guy who simply reinforced those divisions, did not in any way reach across the aisle. And even on the one issue, which I give him credit for pursuing, which is getting needles into arms and getting people vaccinated, even there, he was pedestrian. I'm not partisan in something like this. I'm not ideological. There was nothing that was memorable. There was nothing that was special. What a horrible lost opportunity last night was.
And in that context, how did you analyze or evaluate what Tim Scott did?
I asked 15 students who are not religious to tell me how they felt about at the end when he brought the Bible and he spoke in terms of morality and values and spirituality as opposed to political. And I was shocked because they don't agree with him and they're not religious. And they said if we had a little bit more of that in American politics, we would have so much less of the stuff that we all hate, the viciousness and the anger and the negativity. They responded to his appeal saying that he felt more like he was defending American values than Joe Biden did. That Joe Biden was defending government values and Tim Scott was defending the values of the American people. And that was music to my ears.
Pretty powerful. He's a remarkable guy.
Whether you support him or not, our hope should be that he seeks the presidency. You can only do so much in the Senate. He's watched and he's listened to and he's credible. And I know that he is one of the most popular senators, if not in the top two or three. And they listen to him. And when he speaks, everyone is quiet. But you can only communicate so far by being a senator. You can do so much more by running for president. And I think that he owes it. And I know that sounds strange to say that a human being owes a country something, but he had a very tough upbringing. Single mom, almost flunked out of school, as he talked about. America was good to him, and he's been good to America. But America gave him that leg up. And because of America, and because of his mom, he's been incredibly successful and had an impact. But I think he has to do more. You say this all the time. If you have a special skill, if you have the ability to make a difference, then it's almost criminal if you don't. And that is an appeal that I will make to Tim Scott over the next few months, that it's time to take this show on the road, because it's anything but a show. It's real and it's authentic. And it's exactly what America needs right now.
Yeah, you know, I have a certain bias because he told me years ago that he ran for county commissioner based on the contract with America. And that whole kind of reform spirit is at the heart of what he does. And I used to go down and campaign with him when he was in Congress and then went to the U.S. Senate. I think he's a remarkable talent. Last night may have put him on the map.
But stay there, because the reason why the Contract America was so important, because it was about a platform, about a plan of action, not just because it was specific. The two reasons why people said that it was impactful among the one-third of Americans who voted based on it was, number one, it made a commitment, which politicians don't do. If you remember, at the bottom of that document, we commit to bring these to a vote, not excuses that most politicians make. You said, we pledge to keep our commitments. If we don't, throw us out. That's an enforcement that politicians never did before that and haven't done after that. And second, it was specific. There is actual legislation behind the talking points, real legislation, things that have been written before. You accomplished more in 100 days than any speaker in the history of American politics, because you walked in there, you did the work before you got elected, not after. You did not try to rewrite history. You did it before the election, and people actually voted on it. And my mission with Kevin McCarthy is to have him be that specific, is to have him have the courage of his convictions, knowing that the things that the Republicans support, for the most part, have the support of more than the things the Democrats support. And if he has the courage of his convictions and he has an entire conference working and being honest and candid with the American people, that's how you get elected in this cynical, dark environment.
And frankly, I've talked to Kevin just the last few days. I know that on the retreat that they just had, he outlined the whole concept of an expanded and more detailed commitment to America, which is his version of the contract. And they actually have, I think, 7 working groups that are going to be developing the details. I have to say, back in the days when we did this, I cannot say too much about Dick Armey, because as conference chair, he was the one responsible for getting all the bills written. And of course, one of the great advantages we had that Kevin doesn't have, nobody thought we were going to win. So nobody was willing to put up a big fight against these things, because they thought, well, Newt can do what he wants to, and we all know it's just campaigning. And it was a great shock to some of them when we not only won, but we promptly said, if you're going to be a committee chairman, you're going to report out the bills. And in one case, we had a member I won't name who had 3 major bills in his committee, and he had personally opposed all 3. And we said, well, you certainly have that right as a committee member, but not as a committee chairman. So if you'd like to give up your chairmanship, you don't have to bring these up. And he thought about it for a little while and decided he'd like being chairman.
I love that. Absolutely love that.
How do you see 22? What's your sense? We're still in the early stages of clarifying things.
You and I disagree on this. And I'm very willing to say so publicly, because I don't want to be a Me Too person. And I don't mean what has been used for in the last 2-3 years, that Hill staff and consultants and some members tend to tell leadership what they want to hear rather than what they need to know. And by the way, you were tough at this. You would give me a hard time when I'd say to you that interview wasn't great, or I wouldn't have used that phrase. You would then, after about 15 seconds of chewing me out, because I need to be a little tougher, and I even remember the words you used, you're being destructive, is what you'd say to me. For about 15 seconds, then you say, okay, what did I do wrong? I would give you the line, you would look at me and say, that's good, I'll remember it. And then we go our separate ways. I still remember this. You did this to me outside your office. You did this to me in the statuary hall. You did this to me outside the Capitol, outside the chamber itself. Sometimes when we'd be driving along, you occasionally did this to me at fast food, which was great for both of us. And I say this to the people on this call, you have to have the courage to tell the truth. At a very early stage of my life, I realized that I'd rather lose a contract and draw the ire of the people who I respected more than life itself, because every time I spoke to them, even if I made them mad, they would know that I was saying it because I meant it, because I believed it, and because I was trying to be helpful. And I am not optimistic, because I don't see that unity within the House Republican Conference that it will require when Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and the Democratic machine and Mike Bloomberg's going to spend $100 million and all the money and the corporations that are going to be lined up against them and the media. It is everyone, and they throw in the kitchen sink against you. And Kevin's awesome. Kevin is friendly and Kevin is smart and he's got a great demeanor, the perfect demeanor for right now in American politics. But you've got a conference that is not completely united. There are members of that conference that are controversial. They say controversial things. By the time you reached June of 1994, you had everyone on board. Nobody dared disagree with you because you had the vision and you had an agenda and you had a strategy. I hope he has the ability to bring people together. I hope he has the ability to deliver that sense of unity. I know this, that they were stronger when they walked out of the retreat than when they walked in. I know that Kevin has a better personal relationship with members than any leader, truthfully, even you. Kevin knows his members better, and he doesn't have the same kind of hostility. You are revolutionary. You are upending 40 years of traditional Republican rule, and some people didn't like that. Kevin does not have that challenge, but he still doesn't have people on the same page as much as you did after you took over.
Yeah. This is a remarkable opportunity to talk to one of the best students of American politics that I've ever met. And I think it'd be great to see what people have on their mind.
Frank, how can we get the word out if the media, both print media and social media, just won't talk about it or will block it? I mean, an example is this Hunter Biden situation where the public never heard about it. And it's going to go on right up to the next election. What are your thoughts?
It's going to go on forever. And it's going to go on forever, not just in the media, but we got a problem with academia and we got a problem with entertainment. The three professions that have the greatest impact on how we think and the opinions that we form are the three professions that are at least 80% Democratic and maybe as high as 90%. We don't have a choice. It means that we have to have our finance people investing in movies that paint a pro-American, pro-traditional values message. It means that we have to watch TV shows that actually celebrate the country rather than destroying it. In the media, there are some social media channels. If you ask me what channel I watch to get my news, it's actually CNBC, because they can't be wrong. They can't be biased. People are making billion-dollar financial decisions based on what they hear. And CNBC, while it doesn't give all the news, doesn't talk about all the topics, if you want to know what's really going on economically, it's the best. I read the Wall Street Journal. It's got the best editorial page, but that's not why I read it. I read it because it's most likely to tell you what's happening on the front page and not bash and destroy. You pick up the New York Times, there'll be seven stories on the front page of the business section, and all seven would make you think that the American economic elite are scum. They're not. They're smart. They're innovative. They're still creating and developing every single day. The Wall Street Journal, take a look. Six stories rather than seven. Four of them are positive. Two of them are negative. That's about the right ratio. Well, there are news sources that you can turn to. And in terms of social media, just don't go to the ideological sites. You have to go to a place that prides itself in accountability, which, by the way, is the greatest attribute missing from the government right now. Accountability, transparency. Who's invested in this site? What's the purpose of the site? Because there are places where you can get accurate information. And I believe it's doable. You just have to search more. And once you find that right place, do what I'm doing right here. Tell people about it.
My question is, what are the biggest mistakes or missed opportunities that Republicans are making right now when campaigning and trying to take back the House? And are there any commonalities that you've seen in polls about American attitude that Republicans should be more focused on when trying to take back the House?
I'm going to answer that question. I'm going to give three different examples, then I'm going to have a new comment on it, each one of them individually. Some Republicans have started to call Joe Biden a liar, and that makes me very uncomfortable, because I know that even if you turn out your base, that's awesome in Texas, that's awesome in Florida, that works in Western states. But if you turn out your base in Pennsylvania, you lose seats. If you turn out your base in New York, you lose seats. And for us to be a majority, we cannot win that by losing suburban districts in the South and by losing Northeastern moderate suburban districts. And calling Joe Biden a liar doesn't work. Here's the alternative. The number one phrase that the American people care about the most is actually not tax increases, it's wasteful Washington spending. And the attribute that works the best is waste, fraud, abuse, and corruption. Because if you make a promise to work across the aisle and then you don't, if you're giving your friends in organized labor and special interest groups payouts and sweetheart deals, that by definition is corruption. And I believe that what's happening in the spending, the $1.9 trillion for COVID, which doesn't at all go to COVID, the fact that money goes into the pocket of local bureaucrats, the fact that they're paying for people to organize labor, I think all of that is corruption. And when Republicans don't talk about it that way, they're missing a great opportunity. So I've got two more, but Newt, what's your reaction to that?
No, I agree with that. Gordon Woods wrote a book on the radicalism of the American Revolution and made the point that for the American revolutionaries, in their model, corruption was any decision which was not optimal for the country. So if you gave your idiot cousin a job, you know, that was an act of corruption. It got translated in America into bribery. So if he didn't pay you for the job, it wasn't considered corruption. But they would say, the original founding fathers who were all coming out of the Whig tradition would all have said that when you start passing billions and billions of dollars for the teachers union while they're not going to work, that that is a total act of corruption. And that's billions of dollars, which then have not just the cost effect, but it undermines the moral integrity of the entire culture. And they were very, very big on this concept that only a moral people can be free. So I think they'd be very close to where you are.
Give you a second example. They talk about bipartisanship, which is process, working together, which is intent. What the American people want more than anything else is two words, common sense. And in fact, the best label you can be is a common sense conservative. That means that you've got a brain, you've got discipline, and you've got a heart. And the public really wants all three. They feel that Republicans will manage things better, but that if someone's struggling, they won't hear it as well. They won't empathize as well. But someone with common sense does. They think that the Democrats empathize, but they don't trust their decisions and they don't like how much they'll spend and waste. So my second advice for Republicans is common sense. If you own that attribute and you can demonstrate it, not only do you get your base, but you get centrist voters as well. And that's how you achieve the majority, by starting off with those 42% who vote Republican and adding another 15% that are right of center, but in the center politically. Newt?
I think that's a brilliant formula. I thought this was one of the things that was interesting about Tim Scott's talk last night, that it was largely cultural rather than political. And that he was really touching things like common sense or things like being practical. And I think that the country actually tends to think more in cultural terms than political terms. Reagan was a great example of that. Reagan had an ability to communicate that was astonishing, and that it really involved such basic ideas that people just sort of would nod yes. He had them in the rhythm of what they are, in a sense. And we talked about this briefly last night in your class. It's the whole concept of a responsive chord, where you already know it, but nobody has said it for you. It's really what made Rush Limbaugh so important on the right for a generation, that he would say things that people had been thinking but didn't know how to articulate, and then they would go to have coffee with their friends and tell them what Rush had just said, which is what they already believed before he said it, but they didn't know how to say it. And I think that this whole notion of being calmer, less strident, less angry, and communicating in these kind of core cultural values rather than political values, I think it gives you an enormous advantage.
And I'll add one more. I know you want to take more questions. We don't ask enough questions. Republican politicians walk in and give answers. And I would be angry, Newt, if you ask questions, because you have so much to teach us. But so many of these members would do well for themselves to actually bring in information. The thing I learned in the Reform Party, this is when you and I sat down in September of 1993, and you made the offer to get me involved. You said, what did you learn from the Reform Party? They said, let the people speak first. And that in itself turned politics on its head. Listen to people before you tell them what you think. Listen to them before you give them your solutions, because maybe your solutions aren't going to solve their problems.
The model I've tried to use my whole career is listen, learn, help, and lead in that order. And part of what made the contract work was that we had listened to the American people, and we knew going in that the things we were offering were in fact things they wanted. We weren't going out to sell them. We were going out to reassure them. And I think that there is real truth to the idea that people collectively are much, much smarter than we think they are. And that if you allow them to communicate with you, you inevitably learn things that you would learn. There's a famous story. Reagan is running for governor for the first time. They hire the best Republican firm of the time, Spencer Roberts. And they were very concerned because they wanted to prove that an actor could be governor. So they put together sort of a shoebox full of 4x6 cards with all the major facts about California that you needed. Reagan, who was a professional actor, memorized the whole thing like in one night. And he goes out and he does his first town hall meeting. And the first question that comes up is, what are you going to do about the student demonstrations at Berkeley, which isn't in the cards? And so he gives them an answer. He goes to the second meeting. First question that comes up, what are you going to do about Berkeley? He goes back in the meeting afterwards and he says, guys, you know, we don't have anything on Berkeley. And they say to him, you know, well, Berkeley's not really an issue. And Reagan, who really was pretty good as an actor at figuring out his audience, said, guys, if they think it's an issue, it's an issue. And I think, to me, it's always been one of the great stories about how somebody who you think of as a leader is a leader in part because he's a follower.
I got an idea for you.
Okay.
And I'm not going to wait. We'll do this so you can actually say you changed history on this call. There are about a dozen members that would really benefit from this. Not your philosophy, your stories, your illustrations. This is a different generation. I'm not trying to teach them conservatism. I'm not trying to teach them how to govern. You just gave the perfect illustration for why they need to listen more and talk a little less. And also why the Washington consultants don't always know what they're doing.
Right.
I will put together a dinner for you with 10 members who matter.
If you'll
come. And for 90 minutes, pick the 20 stories, like you just said, to illustrate the things that matter most to you.
Okay, deal. By the way, remember, you hosted a dinner the night of Obama's inauguration. And I thought in retrospect, it was a remarkably prescient dinner and that conversation had a lot to do with the victory of 2010.
Of course, but you haven't told the people on this call that we were accused of being traitors because of that dinner, that reporters wrote about that dinner and lied about it, suggested that we had strategized at that moment to oppose everything that Obama had done, to be obstructionist. And I've never been called a traitor until that night.
No, that's right. I had been, so it probably wasn't as big a shock to me. And this is part of why I kind of understood what was happening to Trump. In the Washington of the 1980s. When I first got there in 1979, the Republicans had been so shattered by Watergate, they'd lost so many of their members, that the leadership was sort of without energy because it's the equivalent of going to funerals. I mean, about a third of their personal friends had been defeated, really had no energy. And Democrats would saunter onto the floor looking for a Republican to kick around. And Republicans would kind of hide so they wouldn't be the one getting kicked around. And what happened was we happened to have an unusually large class. And it included people like Ed Bethune, who'd been a Marine and an FBI agent, and Dick Cheney, who had been the youngest chief of staff to a president. And we also had an All-American football player from Texas. So our attitude was kind of, we weren't impressed that these professional Democrats wanted to come on the floor. And we thought, this is great. Let's fight. And it was an enormous shock to them. And it's part of where my reputation came from, because who are these Republicans to think that they're allowed to be on the floor? They're supposed to go hide in their offices. And so we violated the norms.
And thank God you did. Okay, next question.
I want to know, looking back at the Georgia runoffs and then going to the elections in 2022, what do you think Republicans need to do different that kind of cost them those seats?
I believe that you just asked a question that's going to divide your two speakers right now. I thought that the Republican advertising was horrific. People on this call probably donated a lot of money towards it. It was all hyper critical, hyper negative. The individuals who were going to vote were going to vote no matter what happened. You did not have to drive them to the polls. The problem was you had Donald Trump saying the election was stolen. And so a lot of people did not want to participate. You had people saying, who were allies of Trump, being super Trump, being extreme on that. And it actually depressed turnout. Democrats were completely unified and they were going after the center, repeatedly going after the center. I'm not a strategist who says go after the center. I don't believe you go after the right. I believe you find that sweet spot, that 60% in the majority. I'm right off 30% of the electorate at the beginning. I assume that there's 30% of America that will simply not agree with us. And in Georgia, it's only 20%. We polled on election night. The Republicans had a 4-point generic ballot advantage, if all else was equal. And Perdue ran ahead of Trump. Perdue was only a few thousand votes from getting the majority. He should have won. But he doubled and tripled down on just being all over Trump. And in the Atlanta suburbs, there were an awful lot of Republicans who wanted to vote Republican, but had an issue with Trump's language and his presentation. And we lost them, and we never should have. That's where we lost the election. We had great turnout in the exurbs, great turnout in the rural areas. Of course, the cities turned against us. We knew that was going to happen. It was the suburbs where we saw Republican turnout drop. And we did not get the ticket splitters and swing voters. I don't believe Kelly Loeffler was going to win. I believe that Perdue absolutely should have won that. And it is almost a crime that they spent close to $100 million and still lost the election. Like, I believe people should go to jail.
Well, actually, I'm pretty close to where Frank is, maybe with the exception of going to jail. I thought they were the dumbest campaigns I'd seen, that the consultants who were making a huge amount of money out of the two candidates were brain dead, went back and said, don't I have somewhere in my briefcase a great ad that I ran in 1962 that I want to get out here and try again? My daughter, Jackie Cushman, lives in Atlanta, and I talked to her regularly, and she just said that it was an embarrassment. Both the Democrats were susceptible to losing badly, and both of them end up in a situation where they were running the commercials that said, look, we're nice people, we're non-threatening, we'd like you to get $2,000 apiece, and we're with President Trump when you're getting $2,000 apiece. We don't know why Mitch McConnell won't give you $2,000 apiece. And the two Republican senators were just whipsawed. And then I think you're right, the degree to which the governor and the president were fighting just further froze the turnout, as people just wanted to wash their hands of it and get away from it. As somebody who helped create the modern Republican Party in Georgia starting in 1960, when there was no Republican Party, it was kind of astonishing to watch the suicidal impulses. You know, you talk to these people and they just couldn't unlock. And I frankly worry a little bit about next year, because I think that the underlying civil war between the governor and the President Trump is still there and it's still real. And it could cost us the governorship, could cost us the opportunity to beat Senator Warnock. I mean, Warnock can be beaten and we can keep the governorship. but the current behaviors aren't very encouraging.
I heard Frank speak at a recent Capitol Hill Club presentation, and he presented a chart of words and concepts that tested well in his research for how to win the hearts and minds of the elected. Could he share a summary of his findings?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. I learned this word in 1995, so not during the contract, but in the first 100 days, and that's the word imagine. It's the most powerful word in the English language, because if I ask you to imagine life of perfection, imagine the American dream coming true, imagine anything, and you start seeing and hearing what's inside your heart and what's inside your head. If you ask people to close their eyes and imagine freedom, you'll have 20 different imaginations from 20 different people, and every one of them will be correct. That's one example. The second example is the idea of being a problem solver. They label themselves ideologically. I'm a conservative, I'm a Republican, I listen, or whatever. The public desperately wants elected officials to actually do something, not to talk about it. This is why governors are more popular than senators. Senators are really good at debating. Governors are really good at doing because they have to. So being a problem solver, I'm taking the language of governors and mayors and bring it into politics. So I'm getting out all the negative from the politics and bringing the positive from the executive branch. And third, because I'll give you an example, because we've got the whole woke thing. The public does not want diversity. It wants inclusion. Diversity is about taking someone from the upper row that you see in front of you and one person from the lower row that you see in front of you. Diversity is one of each. And it means that some people get invited and other people don't. Inclusion is all of us. Inclusion is like a hug. And I watch people speak. The way that I present myself, you can see with my hands, is that I want a hug. I want to actually reach out and bring people in and pull them in rather than push them away. Inclusion is unifying. Inclusion is about all of us and our messaging. Get away from the podium. Don't hold a microphone. Give people the chance to be heard. This is all part of a philosophy that comes from populism, but now it transcends ideology. And it's simply the idea that we respect the people to govern themselves, to live their own life, to listen from them, and then try to help them achieve their dreams. But don't get in the way. That's what Newt Gingrich taught me. And he taught me on plane flights, and he taught me at McDonald's drive-thrus, and he taught me when we were in the car, and he taught me wherever we were. And I'll close with saying, I found two of those yellow legal pads. We were on a flight on a private jet. And I don't remember where we were flying, but the flight hit all this turbulence and the plane is going up and down and I'm scared. And I put the pad down and I'm holding on to the arms. And Newt looks at me and he says, what are you doing? And I said, I'm sorry, sir, but I'm afraid. He said, I got a question for you. If the pilot were to open the door and say, please come in here, I need help, could you do anything? I said, no. He said, if the pilot were to get knocked out, could you step into the cabin and do anything to prevent or have any impact on this flight whatsoever? And I said, no. And he said, well, then you have nothing to be afraid of because you will have no impact whatsoever. Pick up your pad, get your pen, and let's continue. I never forgot that because, frankly, no, that did not motivate me. That scared the living hell out of me. But I appreciated the fact that he was willing to be direct with me even when I was afraid as hell. So, Mr. Gingrich, you're the best thing that happened in my life other than my parents, and I'm grateful.
Well, listen, it's terrific that you would spend what turned out to be personal time in terms of our knowledge. I look forward to dinner with you, and I think we need to rebuild and reacquaint what we're doing and how we're doing it. So it's been wonderful that you would spend this time both with me and also with members of our inner circle. So thank you very, very much.
You're very welcome, guys.
Well, let me just say thank you to all of you and to Frank for joining us today. Our next Inner Circle Live event will be Wednesday, May 5th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. So if you have friends who'd like to join us next time, please encourage them to become members of my inner circle today. thank you to my guest, Frank Luntz, and the members of my Inner Circle Club. You can join my Inner Circle by going to newtsinnercircle.com to sign up today. Newt's World is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers. Our producer is Garnsey Sloan, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of Newt's World can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.